I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. For decades, the United States and other countries have been shipping a lot of their plastic waste to China for recycling, more than 100 million metric tons since 1992. That's according to a UN database. That stopped this January after China passed a law halting the import of plastics, saying it was protecting the country's environment and the health of the Chinese people. So now the U.S. and others are trying to figure out what to do with all those plastic containers and bottles and bags, packing material, much of which is single use. We asked Jenna Jambeck to join us, and she knows more about plastic and solid waste management than most. She's an environmental engineering professor at the University of Georgia, also a National Geographic Fellow, and joins us from the studios of the University of Georgia. Jenna Jambeck, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So why doesn't China want our plastic anymore?
Well, what happens when the plastic bales, or the bales of plastic, and it's like a hay bale, actually, when it comes out of the recycling facilities where it's been processed, when it gets into China, people were undoing these bales and sort of hand-picking through this material in like a secondary sort, and there really wasn't the infrastructure to manage what they didn't want of that material, and so it was causing additional plastic pollution within that country, and China realized it might be able to get a cleaner material from other sources.
Talking about cleaner material, one of the complaints that I heard was also just the sort of level of contamination from the plastic that came from the U.S. and other countries.
Mm-hmm. So that's exactly. So in some cases, this means that people are not recycling correctly, if it goes all the way back to that, and materials that aren't supposed to be in those bales are ending up in them. In some cases, the processing units themselves are not getting some of that contamination out. But yes, there was a lot of material in there that they didn't want. And so that's just was really ending up polluting their environment.
So they are not taking any plastic, or they're just being much more fussy about it?
They're being very fussy. So there's it's a very strict contamination rate that really basically cannot be met unless a secondary sort is performed somewhere else, or it's even sort of processed and then pelletized. What they're doing now is actually importing the clean pelletized material instead, because they still are manufacturing a lot there.
Can the United States pick up the slack? And by that, I mean, and it is a little weird when you think about it, that we ship our plastic, you know, halfway around the world to China for recycling. Is this something that could be done here in the United States?
Well, the other thing is that in China, the labor costs were very low. And so that remains a challenge here to do some of that secondary sorting. What I think we need to do is move even further upstream and think about sort of how we're designing our packaging and our products and what makes it so challenging for us to manage in the waste stream in the first place, challenging to separate these plastics out for recycling. If you can think of them, if they were much more monomaterial based, less variety in them, this material would have a higher value.
I looked around my desk in preparation for today's show just to see, frankly, all the plastic that does surround me. I mean, some of which are simple things like the refills that I put in my pen. I mean, that is made out of plastic. And I was looking at it this morning thinking, what do I do with this?
Right. In many cases, people don't know. And, you know, we produce about 34 million metric tons of plastic waste in a year. And we're really only recycling 9% of that. So it's a challenge to recycle anyway. And then what we were recycling, we were then exporting about 2/3 of that to China or Hong Kong together.
That's such a low rate, 9%. You'd think after decades of telling people, you know, recycle your materials, that it's such a low rate. Why is that?
You know, I think it gets back to that variety, because plastic is so useful and can be molded into so many shapes and can be all kinds of colors. It actually makes it quite challenging for recycling. And then getting people, yes, to make that choice to actually recycle that packaging remains a challenge. Yeah, it does. I think accessibility maybe to home recycling. And then I think a lot of this packaging and convenience item is used while we're on the go. And then people may not have a recycle bin near them at that point. And then I think it just gets thrown in the trash.
I'm thinking a bottle of water is an example of that.
Right.
something on the go.
Yeah.
Yep. But I'm also thinking about people that are really dutiful and are sort of carefully doing what they are supposed to do and put their things into a recycling bin. Now, in recycling bins, you can essentially put in plastic and paper and cardboard and things like that. Are they doing the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, we are, because we want to get closer to this circular economy. And those people are doing the right thing. I think the problem is that the packaging, like I said, I'd like to see some of that redesigned so that it makes it easier to recycle and that material is more valuable and we don't have to export it. The move to make it easier for citizens to single stream recycling where everything was put together. So, you, like you said, you get to put your plastic and your paper and the cardboard all in one bin. And then we design these facilities to separate them. But they couldn't get it as clean as you actually need it as the commodity. So that's where some of the challenges lie.
So go back to putting things in various different bins. Would that be helpful?
That, I think it would be helpful for cleaner commodities, but now the infrastructure that we've all developed is related to the single stream. So it's not so easy as switching back. But keeping that stream as clean as possible in terms of not putting things in there that don't belong there. So contacting your local authority to make sure you are recycling correctly. But yeah.
I'm thinking about that 91% then of plastic that doesn't get recycled. Where does it go?
Mm-hmm. So there's another 12% that is on average globally incinerated. And then there's about 79% that either ends up in our landfills, or we also know that some of it now leaks out into our environment and then eventually gets to our oceans.
In fact, I think we've all seen those pictures. And I know you've done some research about the plastic garbage patch, such as it's called, and also seeing some beaches just strewn with plastic debris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we estimated that there's about 8 million metric tons of plastic entering the oceans every year. And that equates to about a dump truck of plastic every minute going in. And so, yeah, some of that ends up floating on the ocean surface. Some of it ends up getting spit back out onto beaches that are deposition sites. And some of it's in our wildlife. It's consumed by our wildlife, yeah.
And again, those are some of the pictures we've seen of birds, you know, with a plastic bag around their neck or even mm-hmm. around their beak so that they can't eat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and bellies full of plastic. Mm-hmm. The albatross are pretty famous for that in terms of consuming plastic, and then they feel full and do not get any nutrients from that plastic, and so they basically starve to death. But we've also seen whales that have consumed plastic bags, turtles as well. So it's impacting a lot of wildlife.
As you said, most of this goes to landfills. So what happens to plastic in a landfill?
Well, for all our knowledge, basically, in terms of our lifespan for biodegradation, plastic doesn't biodegrade these traditional polymers. And so they stay there. When I go visit landfills, which I do a lot all around the world, I see a lot of plastic because that does not biodegrade. It stays there.
And when you talk about visiting landfills, you dig through them to see what's there, right?
That's exactly right. Yep. We do waste characterization studies and really, you know, visit these sites globally to see how waste is being managed, and locally for characterization.
Is there a country that's doing a good job when it comes to dealing with their plastic waste?
You know, I have seen some good examples around the world, and one of them I would say is Norway in terms of their PET bottles, because they have something called an extended producer responsibility policy, and then they provide these design standards, companies that are going to say, we will show the government a certificate that we've recycled over 95% of these PET bottles, and so they follow these design standards so they can actually do that and recycle them bottle to bottle, and that's one of the very few places that can do that because they have those standards and those policies in place.
Interesting. And how does the United States compare with this?
So our rate for PET is about 30%. So that is actually the highest polymer that we recycle. Mixed together, as I said, our recycle rate for plastic is only 9%.
Exactly. You mentioned technology. And I mean, one does see more biodegradable materials instead of things like plastic knives, forks, spoons, things like that. Is that where the future should go?
Yeah, I think Partly, you know, I would go even up front more and in reducing our reliance on these single use items. But where you do need packaging, think about redesigning it and also looking at alternative materials. And that's something we're doing here at the university in our new Materials Institute. So traditional biodegradable materials, or now newly actually biodegradable polymers like PHA. Are potential alternatives that would have certain applications. Not going to be everything, but certain applications.
But with this ban from China, I mean, it seems like we're going to have to deal with our plastic problem in that if it's not going to go somewhere, it's going to be here in our own backyard that we've got to figure out what to do to deal with it.
Right. Yeah, we estimated globally there'd be 111 million metric tons displaced by this policy. And there is no other country that has the capacity to take as much as China was taking. And so we've seen some of it starting to go to other countries like Vietnam and Malaysia and Thailand. But those countries also said, hey, this is too much for us. We can't handle this either. And so, yeah, it's staying in the U.S. And then folks, it's either being stockpiled. In some cases, some facilities have decided to try to start processing it themselves. And in other cases, they're just disposing of it. So every community is sort of different in what actions they've had to take.
I noticed a number of cities have banned plastic straws, or communities have banned plastic straws. I know there's a bill here, or at least something under consideration in Philadelphia City Council to ban plastic bags. Would that be enough to make a difference?
Well, both of those things do not weigh a lot. So when you're looking at the way we look at solid waste in terms of mass, those probably don't have a high impact. However, in terms of count and what we actually find in the environment and those two items having impact on our ecosystems, those can make a difference. And those are also problematic items in our recycling facility. Right. Bags cause tangling. We call them tangles at the recycling facilities, and straws. We have an issue here. They end up in our glass stream. And so actually people trying to recycle those items is a challenge. So in some cases, the bans will really help us to be able to manage the waste better.
And Jenna, the 45 seconds we have left, and people always want to know, so what is the one big thing that people can do to reduce our plastic use?
Yeah, so I think for us, we produce about 2 to 3 times more waste per person than those other countries around the world, especially in Southeast Asia. And so for us, the simple things, the reusable water bottle, if you have access to clean water, reusable bags, reusable mugs, they sound simple, but taken collectively, the research shows that absolutely can have an impact. And so we can make those choices and know and tell other people to make those same choices, and that will grow that way.
Well, Jenna Jambeck, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. She's an environmental engineering professor at the University of Georgia, a National Geographic Fellow, and again joined us from the studios of the University of Georgia. And we have 3 guests staring at me, waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about this issue as it relates to the Delaware Valley, to Chester, Pennsylvania, and to you. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We've been talking about the fact that China doesn't want our plastic anymore after years of accepting our plastic waste for recycling. Now we have to figure out what to do with the containers and products we carefully put into our recycling bins, some of which are now being hauled to incinerators and landfills. Covanta operates an incinerator in Chester, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia, has been burning more plastic as a result of the ban. Residents of that city are concerned about the health effects from smokestacks and increased truck traffic. And that's what we're going to be talking about as we continue this conversation on Radio Times. And let me introduce our 3 guests. Julene Mayfield is chairperson with the Chester Residents Concern for Quality Living. Julene Mayfield, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Nice to have you with us. Marilyn Howarth is with us as well. She's an occupational and environmental medicine physician working with the Center of Excellence in Environmental Toxicology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Marilyn Howarth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And rounding out our trio of guests is Paul Gilman, Senior Vice President, Chief Sustainability Officer at Covanta, And that's the company that operates the incinerator in Chester and in other parts of the country as well. Paul Gilman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Let me start with you, Paul. What is the impact of China's ban on Covanta?
Well, we've been asked by a number of departments of environment around the country and some communities, would we take their recyclables? Generally speaking, we say no.
You don't want them?
We don't want them. They pose something of an operational difficulty in terms of running the units. They also wind up backing out the regular municipal solid waste, all of which has some plastics in it, of course, some non-recyclable plastics and the like. But the greater levels start to make it difficult for us to process the trash for the communities where we operate today.
But you would say that you are incinerating more plastic as a result
of
the
ban? We are seeing an uptick in some communities. They are ceasing their recycling programs, and they're looking for other outlets. They're trying to re-engineer them, just as your previous guest, Jenna, was talking about.
Julie Mayfield, let me get you in on the conversation. As someone who has lived in Chester for a number of years now, what are your concerns?
Our concerns, they always are. We are a city of 33,000 people being impacted by the habits of millions. We bear the brunt of all the pollution. We bear the brunt of the trucks, the diesel fumes, the dioxins, all of the nasty things that come out of the stack of an incinerator. And it's not just an incinerator. It's the largest incinerator in the country.
So from your perspective, that has affected the quality of life for people living in
Chester? Oh, absolutely. Not only quality of life, but direct correlation to their health concerns and their health issues, especially our children who are suffering from some staggering levels of asthma and bronchial issues.
Let me turn to you, Marilyn Howarth. And you look at this from a sort of epidemiological public health perspective. What do you see when you look at Chester? We've got Covanta there. We've got health concerns. Is there a cause and effect?
Well, I think that looking at the very significant health effects that Chester experiences as an environmental justice community, you really have to look at the whole picture. Unfortunately, it is a community that is overburdened by environmental insults, and there are so many sources. It's really not right to look at a single source. Not only are there a number of industrial sources, but their I-95 runs right through Chester, and I think it's really important to look at this holistically and the cumulative impacts on the community.
But picking up what Zulene said, is it true then that people living in Chester have some serious chronic health concerns?
Yes, it absolutely is. The latest data on asthma, as she mentioned, is 23%. The national rate for asthma in children is 8%.
23.
Yes, so 23 is really quite high, and it is, asthma is a multifactorial disease, and there's no question that there are a number of other contributors, but we feel strongly that there's also a significant environmental contribution.
And we should say that not only is Covanta there, the incinerator, there's a water treatment facility, there are paper mills, there's a medical waste facility as well.
Yes, there are a number of industries that actually are required to report to the EPA on the toxic release inventory, and there are quite a few in Chester.
You want to speak to that and what it's like to live in Chester, Zulene?
Well, Chester is like any other community. It's my home. And everyone wants the best thing for their homes. There are a number of different sources that are in Chester that are polluting. However, we find that the incinerator is probably the biggest assault on our lives. It has changed the community tremendously. There are other triggers for asthma and health concerns, but by far, particulate matter and the other things, they are direct links to trigger asthma attacks in children and elderly, and now in those that were supposedly well-bodied. Everybody's walking around with inhalers. So the community needs to have a chance to bounce back. And the assault that we get from numerous, multiple permits, we've been at this since 1991, fighting permit after permit. And the permits are basically a license to pollute. Just because they are given a permit, don't assume that it's safe.
Well, let me go back to you, Paul Gilman, and help us understand from your perspective what Covanta is doing there in order to protect the people that live around the facility.
Sure. And actually, Chester and Zulane kind of started a whole movement in this country to better understand how various different activities we do in a community affect the population. The whole environmental justice movement was born in Chester, and we all benefit from that higher level of awareness. And as a company, when my company acquired the facility in Chester, we took the opportunity to learn about how the community and the facility had been interacting. It was one of the first things that I got to participate in when I came to the company was our development of a community outreach and environmental justice policy, which really laid out the fact that we have to be completely transparent with the community as to how we operate, when we want to change things in the facility and the like. So we've actually, our experience in Chester has helped us, I think, be a better company and be something of a leader in trying to encourage other companies to listen.
Are you saying you're a good neighbor? I mean, you would use those words to describe what you do.
That's what we try and do. That's what our whole sustainability program is about. So the Clean Air Act, I would tell you, is one of our industry's best friends. When our industry came under it in 1990, there's dramatic change. Thousands, literally, of facilities that didn't have air pollution control equipment closed. Those that did got better equipment. The emissions were dramatically reduced, above 90% in most instances. And as a company, we've continued to try and improve those emissions.
Well, let me get a response from Zulane. How do you see it? What do you see in
response? Well, we see it like this, Mr. Gilman. We want you to be better at what you do. And one of the very first things that you can do, right now that facility you have is the largest that you operate. You have smaller facilities that operate about, they burn about 1,000 tons a day. Those facilities have 4 pollution control devices. The largest incinerator in the country, in the city of Chester, that burns 3,500 tons a day, only has 2 controls. We're asking, requesting, that the other 2 and the third one be added to that facility. If your intent is to reduce the emissions, in any way, any reduction is going to be beneficial to our children. And it is essential that it's not, oh, a cost and effective thing. Let's do what we can do to minimize the impact for the people that live in that city.
Right.
That is what we are requesting and demanding.
Absolutely.
And just so, Zulane, just want to make sure our listeners understand. So you're saying is Covanta needs to do more to reduce the pollution.
They need to do the very least that they do in other communities.
Yes. Okay.
And so, you know, that has been our philosophy. That has been our practice. Just in the past 5 years, sulfur compounds are down at that facility 38%. Mercury emissions down over 50%. Dioxin furans down over 88%. And let me just say, there is a huge body of literature looking at whether or not these facilities cause health effects in their communities. Most recently, the city of Portland was looking at moving some of their waste to a facility that we operate south of the city. They contracted with a firm to take a look at that body of literature and ask the question, does the literature predict health effects? Do we actually see in the monitored populations and people whose blood is measured for whether or not there are compounds in it that are related to the facilities? And they found neither with the emissions levels that the facilities operate today predicted outcomes or actual outcomes of health effects.
Let me give you a chance. Marilyn, you've been listening as I have and our listeners have been listening. What is your response then to what we're hearing from Paul Gilman and Zulane Mayfield?
Well, Marty, I think in some ways they're really both right. I think it's all about the permitting. The study that Paul is describing, as far as from my understanding of it, is referring to the Portland plant, and that plant actually is only 500 tons a day rather than the 3,500 tons a day.
So it's a smaller plant.
Yes.
No,
and
no,
so
it was actually a survey of all the world's literature of plants all over the world, and it was not just about that facility.
Okay.
It was looking at the scientific information about whether or not these facilities cause health effects.
Go ahead.
Right. And I have seen some of those surveys, and most of the time what they're relying on is looking at the measured particulate matter 10. Now, particulate matter 10 is the big particles.
The ones you can see?
No, you still can't see them. But they don't get into the deepest parts of the lung, and they have never been associated with asthma or heart disease. And so when we, though, do studies to look at the smaller particles, those PM2.5, that's when we see a clear indication of asthma and heart disease correlation. And in fact, this Covanta plant, according to the National Emissions Inventory, puts out 100 tons of PM2.5 every year. And those are the kinds of emissions that I'm most concerned about as a physician.
When you said this plant is the one in Chester,
The one in Chester.
Yes.
Those particulate, though very small particulate, are also coated. They act almost like little taxis. They are coated with the carcinogens, the metals, and they can get very deep in the lungs and cause the kinds of health effects that we're most worried about.
I have several questions. Suleen, looks like you want to say something. You want to add?
I just want to add, listen. I'm trying to do this and keep my language in check.
I appreciate that.
The studies are only as good as whoever pays for the studies. We don't have to be rocket scientists. You can literally walk down an entire block in the city of Chester and see on every house, no smoking. That denotes to me that there are some respiratory illnesses going on. And that's in the 100 block of Thurlow Street, if you want to walk up the street and take a look at it.
And that's near the Covanta?
Oh, that's directly. Okay. It's not 30 feet from their fence line. We're not here to debate the science. The science is already there. Incinerators are dirtier. They emit more even than coal power plants. The incinerator in the city of Chester emits more pollution than the refineries down in neighboring Marcus Hook. Every day you pollute, every day, every minute, according to the monitors that Department of Environmental Pollution Protection has on your facility, every day you emit pollution. Every day you're out of compliance.
Paul, let me give you a chance to go ahead.
No, that's just not accurate.
Okay.
Everything has an emission. Your automobile, a facility, a refinery, an ice cream factory. And we are required by the state of Pennsylvania and federal law to operate at certain levels. We operate for the regulated emissions on the order of 90% below what we're permitted to emit. And the reason we do that is because of our respect for the community. We are going beyond the emissions requirements that are put out there by the regulators.
Let me pick up on that and go to you, Marilyn. Then are those EPA standards, are they stringent enough? And if Covanta is trying to stay below the high levels there, is that enough?
Well, the EPA enforces the Clean Air Act, but it's up to the State Department of Environmental Protection, to issue the permits. And as part of their process of issuing a permit to everything that has a smokestack, basically, they unfortunately are not able to and don't consider all of the other emissions that the average citizen is exposed to. So that when they're considering what should be in a particular permit, they're not considering that I-95 is running through Chester. They're not considering all of the other permits that they have given. The only thing that they need to consider is that The Chester area is in a non-attainment area, and so there are some additional restrictions that they apply, but it's not good enough. And I think the health statistics that show the disparities in Chester are really the evidence for that.
Well, I'm thinking about, and I'll go back to you, Zulene Mayfield, the fact that, you know, what other community in our listening area has an incinerator, a water treatment facility, a paper mill, medical waste facility as well, and also has a highway running right through the middle of it?
Well, actually, there's two highways now. 291, in my opinion, is considered to be a highway. There are probably, we averaged 7 to 8 diesel trucks going into the Covanta plant per minute every day. So that is a different level of ground level pollution that occurs there. Yes, these facilities are permitted by the Department of Environmental Protection. We call it the Department of Environmental Pollution because it's basically a permit. And it says that you are permitted to pollute. Now, what happens is that once they're out of compliance, which is every day, those fines are assessed in quarterly slots. Then the polluter sits down with the state and they negotiate what the fine ought to be. And they just continue to pollute, and they pay the fines.
And I just have to reiterate, we are not in violation every day.
Okay.
Are you in violation some days?
We have days where we might have very wet waste, and the measure we use to know how efficient our combustion is carbon monoxide. And so we may get an indication that because of the wet waste that we have a carbon monoxide exceedance. And if it goes for longer than a set number of minutes, we report that to the department, and we're taking actions to improve the combustion again. The first line of defense in emissions is to have very efficient combustion. That's why the facility is required by the state regulator to operate at very high temperatures.
We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. We got a lot of folks that want to join us as well. That's Paul Gilman, Senior Vice President, Chief Sustainability Officer at Covanta, the company that operates the incinerator in Chester. Marilyn Howarth is with us as well, and she's an environmental medicine physician. And Zulene Mayfield is Chair of the Chester Residents Concern for Quality Living. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Just a quick recap here. Starting in January, China stopped accepting a lot of recyclable plastic from America and the rest of the world, and that is having a big impact on what to do with all that plastic that we use, sometimes recycle, sometimes throw out. In Chester, a trash incinerator has begun to burn some excess plastic because cities like Philadelphia are trying to figure out what to do with this ban from China, and there are concerns in the community this could lead to health problems, or that there are existing health problems exacerbated by this ban. Let me turn to you, Marilyn. I understand what both Paul and Zulene are talking about, but it seems, and this is what our first guest was talking about, we have to figure out what to do with our plastic waste. I mean, we have to start there so that communities like Chester aren't sort of bearing the burden of our throwaway society.
Absolutely. I think that it would be a shame if we used this setback as an opportunity to change what the progress we've made with recycling. I think every American should continue to separate recyclables, even if they're not currently being recycled right now, because I think it would be a shame to get out of the habit. I think we, for sustainability for our country, we absolutely need to remove these from the waste stream and deal with them in a manner that is safe.
Would you agree with that, Paul?
Oh, absolutely. The, you know, one of the marvelous things about doing waste management in a very sustainable way is it has a great benefit for climate change. The doing of recycling reduces the amount of energy we need to use to make new metals, new plastics, and the like. The avoidance of sending wastes that go to landfills and make methane gas, all of that has a very beneficial effect for the greenhouse gas picture.
How do you see that, Zulene Mayfield?
Oh, Well, you know, methane gas is one thing, but arsenic, cadmium, mercury, dioxins, particulate matter, those are a different type of nasties. And unfortunately, we are all being impacted. It's not just about recyclables. We're talking about the amount of garbage that is coming into little teeny Chester, a city of 30,000 people, and we're taking, and you're bringing in waste from New York, Philadelphia, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, as far away from as Puerto Rico. So why should we as residents have to bear the brunt of everybody else's customs? And really, it has changed our way of life. People, we have porch homes. People don't sit on the porches anymore because you can't take the dust and the smell of the fuel, of the trucks that come in there. So now, the bright idea is we're going to train it in from New York, send it to Delaware, and then put it on the truck and bring more trucks into the city. Incineration is not a viable way to deal with our trash. It is not. They're more costly and they emit more pollution than any other process.
Are you talking about landfills? I mean, that.
Yes.
And you're shaking your head. And then I do want to get some folks to join us.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact of the matter is, in places like the European Union and the like, the way of trying to move towards a more circular economy is to increase the rate of recycling. In Germany, for example, they recycle as much as we landfill, over 60%. What they do in Germany is then do energy recovery, like we do at our facility, with the balance. They landfill less than 1%. We landfill 63% of our waste. So I think it does represent what the world sees largely as the more sustainable approach to waste management. In the past 5 years, over 120 facilities have opened up around the world, for example.
Well, which raises the question, do we just do it wrong in this country? I mean, are other countries doing this better, Meryl?
Yes, there are some better regulations in European countries than we have in terms of the emissions. And I think it's very important to recognize that these incinerators often end up in environmental justice communities, places where there are already too many emissions from other sources, and our regulatory process does not have a way of synthesizing all of those emissions so that we can develop a good enough understanding about how to protect the individual citizen.
Because we don't know where things are coming from, you meaning? Well, especially in a place like Chester, you've got all these various facilities there.
Because each individual permit is determined in isolation. It's not determined based on the sum total of emissions that are already allowed in that area.
Cumulative effect.
That's right. That's exactly right.
I'm sure everyone has more to say here. Let me get Alisa from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Alisa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm a scholar in this field, and so I study a lot about this, and there's two points that I wanted to bring up. One, why are we so hyper-focused on recycling? I mean, it's better than, obviously, landfilling or incineration, but why are we not talking about our distribution models and how everything comes in a single-use package that needs to be processed? I mean, this is a system failure that we can do better at. And two, I want to bring up the fact that we're always talking about the emissions from the landfill, but can our guests maybe talk about what's coming out of the bottom of the incinerator. I mean, the incinerators. Can we discuss about the fly ash that we can't throw into a landfill and it's super toxic? And can the guests just talk on that a little bit?
Sure. No question. Sure. I'll toss that first to Paul Gilman and then to Salim.
Actually, it isn't super toxic. One of the things that we have to do by rule from the EPA is test our ash as it leaves the facility. To see whether or not it's leaching anything that is inappropriate, like heavy metals and the like. It has to pass that test before it can go to a landfill. The better news is we're just starting a facility up in Fairless, Pennsylvania, that's going to take our ash, and we'll be able to recycle probably about 65% of the ash using the sands, the aggregates, and the like. Recovering even more metal. We recover about 600,000 tons a year of metals from that ash. So,
Jazeline Mayfield, you want to add to that?
The caller is correct. It's a hazardous material. It is landfilled, and it's quite dangerous. The exposure to that is not good, especially when they come out of the incinerator, untarped or poorly tarped,
which is worse. Flying off?
Yes, many times. We have many times where they are not tarped right or in the correct manner. So these things are going up and down all of southeastern Pennsylvania.
As trucks are driving on the road?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Paul, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, it isn't hazardous. I mean, I just said it has to be tested.
Marilyn, go ahead.
There's a big debate in the scientific community about just how hazardous it is. There is no question that there are hazards in fly ash, but they vary. And we in this country have not chosen to put fly ash in a hazardous waste type landfill. We've instead allowed it to go to a variety of places, some of which are not as well contained as communities should expect.
Let me read an email. Actually, there were several questions about the Covanta plant in Plymouth meeting. Let me just read one from Sarah. There was a malfunction at Covanta Plymouth in December after several hours of steam being released through an emergency rooftop boiler vents. Not the normal smokestack process. A stench of smell encroached on our neighborhood. I instantly got a headache, felt ill, could not be outside, and people are concerned in Plymouth meeting. Can you speak specifically to that?
Sure. Hi, Sarah. I was with Sarah two nights ago.
Oh, you were? Okay, good.
The incident in question was the facility had to shut down quickly, and just like a steam radiator, you have to release the steam, so it's very loud. But the steam itself is isolated from the combustion process. There's none of the concerned pollutants are part of that steam. Now, I know that Sarah smelled something.
Mm-hmm.
We had people who work at our facility, who live in her neighborhood, who smelled something. I would respectfully suggest it was something else in the community that was there before we even had that steam trip.
Let me turn back to you, Zulie Mayfield. Do you want Covanta out of your neighborhood?
Oh, absolutely. We will gladly share that wealth with anybody who wants it. That is our ultimate goal, for it not to be there, for it not to be operational, and for it not to work, period. But in the interim,
right,
there are some things that Covanta absolutely has to do out of respect for our community. I think it is very disrespectful to tell the community that the other three pollution control devices that you would put on your other incinerators, that Chester doesn't warrant it, even though it's the largest incinerator that you operate. I think that is so disrespectful, and that's not even doing the baseline things that you could do that would improve the quality of life for some of the people in Chester. I think it's absolutely necessary thing to do.
Is there more that Covanta can do in Chester?
Well, in terms of trying to contribute to the lives of people
absolutely,
there in Chester,
right,
we do participate in a number of things in the city, ranging from things that sort of are associated with us all the way through the things that are not. So we do support.
I'm not talking about giving a grant to a baseball team.
And
I'm not talking about any of those things.
And as
I'm talking about in direct relation to the operation of the incinerator.
And as I said before, we're operating for a list of emissions 90% below the permitted level. As I just told you, just over the past 5 years, we've continued to improve the levels of emissions and reduce them even further. And this is in a context, too, of not having anything that we do there want to be disruptive of the community. And so we are constantly trying to find ways, collaborating with the community, to do it in a more integrated way.
Go ahead, Marilyn.
I've been on the Chester Environmental Partnership for a number of years, and I can attest to the fact that we do review permit violations of the industries in Chester, and Covanta is not in violation of their permit. I can't swear that they've never been, but you know, largely, this is not a problem for this plant. However, there are a number of things that they could do that would actually be very meaningful to the health of neighborhood people in Chester. For instance, the hundreds of trucks that go through the neighborhood Covanta could be supplying incentives and replacement dollars for trucks, because the newer trash trucks are much less polluting. That would have a real benefit to community members in Chester. It's very hard to suggest to them that they really should be exceeding their permit requirements. They already do by the numbers, and I've already mentioned that I don't think the permits are where they need to be.
Exactly.
But there are these other things that can really be done, especially with those trucks that are going through the neighborhoods.
What do you think about that, Julie Mayfield?
Well, you know, the EPA recommended that you add these other pollution control devices. That was done. Yes, you are part of something called the Chester Environmental Partnership. However, the Chester Environmental Partnership is chaired or boarded by somebody who used to work at Covanta.
I don't know who that is.
But it's funded impartially by Covanta.
Yes, we are asked to support the partnership, and we do.
Of course.
And we're asked to support the city, and we provide a host fee to the city.
Well, that's a requirement. You do that in every other community. So a community host agreement, that's just an agreement that is required with most of these incinerators. We're talking about a legitimate thing that you could do that will have direct impact on the community, not only just Chester, because the pollution that comes out of the stack at Covanta falls, I think, some 17 miles out. So we're not only impacted.
And I'm looking at the clock here, and I do want to pick up on something that Marilyn said and put it to you, Paul, which is this idea of at least having modern trucks that do not pollute like old trucks.
Yes.
What's the possibility?
Well,
of that?
I mean, first of all, we don't operate the trucks that come in. We have worked, for example, in some communities to see if we can encourage the movement to natural gas-fueled vehicles. In some communities, they're even wondering if
we could... As opposed to diesel, I guess?
Yes, if we could explore electric vehicles. Now, these are trucks we're talking about, so that's a little more challenging. But that's a possibility. But we're also asking then communities to buy new trucks when communities are strapped for funds in the first place. So it's sort of kind of this continuous cycle of how do we solve this problem? People don't want to spend a lot of money on their solid waste management system. They'd rather spend it on their school system, for example.
Covanta could provide some financial incentives to make it less burdensome for those municipalities and a lot of the waste is also brought by individual haulers, trucking companies that then by changing out those trucks could have impacts then far and wide in other areas as well.
We are almost out of time. I really regret saying that because there's so much more to talk about. Zulene Mayfield, I'm giving you the last word. I'm giving you 30 seconds.
Thank you so much. I'm just here to say that everybody has a stake in this, but nobody has a stake more viable than the people that live in the city of Chester. This is a survival for our lives. This is a fight because we believe we're worth fighting for. This is a community that we love, and it's our home. And we should have more of a say than any bottom line, any trucker, any incinerator, anything. We were there before they were there, and we're going to be there after they shut down. And we will continue this fight because nobody bottles up air.
We're going to end it on that note. My thanks to all three of you. I really appreciate all three of you coming in and telling us about your perspective on such an important issue. Zulene Mayfield is chairperson with the Chester Residents Concern for Quality Living. Paul Gilman, Senior Vice President, Chief Sustainability Officer at Covanta. That's a company that operates an incinerator in Chester. And Marilyn Howarth is Occupational and Environmental Medicine Physician working with the Center of Excellence in Environmental Toxicology at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. My apologies to all the folks that wanted to get in on the conversation. We'll have to do a part two sometime. Thanks so much for joining us.